From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I said, "Hail, bold adventurers. I seek to cross the dangerous zone of Flanipina, and I request your assistance. Please come to meet me." And they just broke out laughing, because it turns out you never speak that way.
So all the virtual world's stage two. They just don't speak Elizabethan English there. We'll explore the fantasy worlds of online role-playing games in this hour as we focus on the idea of identity.
And the digital possibilities have enveloped us and really created identities and multiple identities and virtual identities for all of us. So much so that it's hard to tell which of the real people we are.
That's video artist Lynn Hirschman Leeson. She'll tell us about the self-replicating automatons that she creates. Also, alternative country singer-songwriter Robbie Foulkes reminisces about his former identity as a songwriter for a music publishing company. But first, we all think we know who we are and that our identities are fixed, but so much of our identity is wrapped up in how other people see us. Take Jorge Drexler, for example. Drexler is the first person from Uruguay to win an Academy Award. Drexler won the Oscar for composing the song Al Otro Lado del Rio from the film The Motorcycle Diaries. He became a national hero in Uruguay. Although Drexler sings the song on the soundtrack, he was not allowed to sing it at the Academy Awards ceremony. Instead, it was performed by Antonio Banderas and Santana. Jorge Drexler talked to Steve Paulson about his Oscar-winning song and his identity as an immigrant.
I would have loved to have something to say on who would sing the song, but I wasn't that naive to think that just because I wrote the song, I would get to sing it. It happened to almost all the other songs.
Yeah, there was an amusing and quite embarrassing moment right before the awards ceremony at the Oscars. Joan Rivers was doing her telecast on the red carpet, and she was cornering stars, and she grabbed Antonio Banderas and his wife, Melanie Griffith.
Now, you got so much flack because you're singing the song. Mm-hmm. How stupid is that?
Very.
Who would people rather see, you singing or somebody they don't know?
Well, you know what? No, Jorge is with us, the guy who sang it. He came with us. He doesn't
bring
him
in.
Jorge!
Jorge!
Could you sing?
Clavo mi remo en el agua.
It's stupid, but I think it's what most people think. She's being sincere. I mean, I have never seen a ceremony of the Oscars in my life. Only saw some afterwards, some maybe Benigni jumping over the seats. Or I'm not from the cinema world. I never thought in my life that I would have one of those statues at home like I do now. I don't have a television at my house. I have a TV to watch DVDs, but I don't have an antenna, so I don't watch air television. I'm not related to the media. I think she's right. I think most of the people, including Gil Cates, producer of the show, preferred to have, as they told me, high-profile talent. I think it wasn't personal. I'm just not known. And to be known is something that it's very important in the media world. But I learned a lot of things. I learned in which area I take my decisions. I learned what am I doing in this job. I learned what do I write songs for. And I'm lucky that those things remained clear for me and for the people that saw what I was doing there. I wrote a letter. It was in Spanish. I wrote it basically to the Spanish media because I'm just starting right now to relate to the English media. I wrote that letter, and I thought that I had said everything that I wanted to say. So there were like two crazy weeks, but afterwards I remained calm. I said what I have to say. I'll do what I have to do if they give me the award. I will sing, and that's what happened.
And the Oscar goes to Jorge Drexler for Al Otro Lado del Rio.
Clavo mi remo en el agua, llevo tu remo en el mío. Creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río. El día le irá pudiendo poco a poco al frío. Creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río.
Ciao.
Now, you were already famous in your native Uruguay, but I've heard that you became a national hero after this. After you won the song, your country's biggest newspaper said it's the most significant thing to happen in Uruguay in many years. It was a triumph of dignity. That's pretty heady stuff.
That's nice, but it's overrated, I think. It's like, I don't like heroes. I'm not a heroic person. I don't like myths. I like human beings that make mistakes, and sometimes they do the right thing and sometimes they do wrong things. But you have to think that we're a very, very small country. Uruguay has 3 million people of population, and it's the smallest country in the continent between the two biggest countries in the country, Brazil and Argentina. So we always got that feeling that the world doesn't know about us. And it's true. We're a very small country lost in the south. So when something like this happens, they tend to relate it, like, for example, when we won the World Cup, Soccer World Cup in 1950, people tend to exaggerate the meaning of what happens to Uruguayans in the outer world. But I don't know, I just took the nice part of it and I kindly rejected the heroic part and mythical part of what happened. I don't want to relate to that kind of stuff.
Well, there's a great story from what I've heard about how you wrote this song. I mean, you were, I think it happened right in this house where we're sitting right now, here in Madison. And the original idea came to you in a dream?
One night I got a FedEx with a script. I read it at around 8. I went to sleep around 10:30. And I woke up very early, 6:30, I think, with the idea that I had about the other side of the river. The song was going to speak about that scene when he's crossing the river. And I would use that metaphor. It's a very used metaphor in all cultures, no? From the river that separates the dead from the living, the river that separates the rich from the poor, like it happens with Mexico. And like a river as a border between two worlds. And I would focus in the will to change things and to risk your life moving from one side to the other of the river, which was the nicest thing about the film.
Clavo mi remo en el agua, llevo tu remo en el mío. Creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río.
Well, my impression is that you're very interested in this connection between technology and art. Mm-hmm. It's a subject that comes up in a number of your songs. I mean, for instance, you have there's a song, Guitar and You, and the first line is, long live science, long live poetry.
Hay tantas cosas, yo solo preciso dos. Mi guitarra y voz. Mi guitarra y voz.
Tell me about that song.
I must confess, I don't have a systematic education in the humanistic area. I'm a medicine student that got his degree and worked as a doctor for 2 or 3 years. I love to read. I did study music for a long time, classical music, composition, guitar, classical guitar. But the way that I see the world, it's more related to a guy that studied biology than somebody who studied cinema or poetry. I'm just learning about literature. I try to be more systematic right now. I always read. My house had lots of books and had a very big library at home and hundreds and thousands of records all over the world. We always grew up with music and literature. But I still see the world through my scientific formation. And I think that there's a very strong connection between poetry and science. And my friends that were from high school and then university, and they're still the good scientists, they have a big intuition and they have a poetic view of life. And the good poets are very interested in going into the deep meaning of things like the scientists do.
Is that central to your identity, to see yourself as an immigrant?
Identity is central in my songs. And to be an immigrant and son of immigrants and father of an immigrant, probably, it's essential in my identity. So it's like, I think that tendency, I don't remember 2 generations of my father's family, for example, that have stayed at the same place. They moved from Poland to Germany, from Germany to Bolivia, from Bolivia to Uruguay. I moved from Uruguay to Spain. I really think, I don't know, we might be searching for something. I don't know what.
Well, you have another song called Milonga of the Jewish Moor with the lines, I am a Jewish Moor who lives among Christians. I don't know who my God is, nor who are my brothers.
Mm.
Very interesting song.
Those particular four lines were written, I took them from a Spanish poet. And that could only be written by a Spanish poet or by somebody from Spain, that they really have the feeling that they're the intersection of those three cultures.
Christian, Jewish, Muslim.
Christian, Jewish, and Muslim. And to say that in Spain right now is very powerful. It's very... I found that quartet. Yo soy un moro judío que vive con los cristianos. No sé qué Dios es el mío ni cuáles son mis hermanos, that you just translated. I really felt I wanted to sing that kind of stuff in that particular moment. That song was written before the Iraq War and before March 11th in Madrid.
Before the bombings at the train station.
Yes, though it was written after September 11th. And I had the feeling that those verses really delivered something important at this moment. Learning that even though you should know your identity, you should know who you are, that doesn't allow you to classify people, dividing people between bad people and good people just because they have different religions. I mean, making that hierarchical division.
Por cada muro un lamento en Jerusalén, la dorada y mil vidas malgastadas por cada mandamiento. Yo soy polvo de tu viento y aunque sangro de tu herida y cada piedra querida guarda mi amor más profundo. No hay una piedra en el mundo creído el pueblo elegido. Yo soy un moro judío que vive con los cristianos. No sé qué Dios es el mío ni cuáles son mis hermanos. No sé qué Dios es el mío ni cuáles son mis hermanos. Yo soy un moro judío que vive con los cristianos.
That's Academy Award-winning songwriter Jorge Drexler with a song called Milonga de Moro Judio, Milonga of the Jewish Moor, from his album Echo. Drexler spoke with Steve Paulson.
For example, it's very common for people to cross genders without feeling like, oh, you know, I'm becoming a woman. I can just play a female character and see what that feels like.
Coming up, the gender-bending, shape-shifting fantasy world of online role-playing games. Also, the multiple identities of artist Lynn Hirschman Leeson, as we continue to explore identity. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. What do you do if you're a struggling artist in search of recognition? Well, if you're Lynn Hirschman Leeson, you write reviews of your own work under pseudonyms and get them published in the newspaper. For more than 30 years, Hirschman Leeson has created pioneering artwork in various media, including photography, performance art, video, film, web-based work, and interactive sculpture. Her groundbreaking art explores issues of reality and identity, and it's chronicled in the new book, The Art and Films of Lynn Hirschman Leeson, Secret Agents, Private Eye. And Strange Champs talked to Lynn Hirschman Leeson about her diverse art, starting with her 1986 work Confessions of a Chameleon from the video series The Electronic Diaries.
So when I was small, and when I was little, and there would be these kinds of episodes of battering, I would go up to my attic and almost retreat into myself. And I would create these characters, each of which had their own life.
You made a series of videos called The Electronic Diaries in 1986, mm-hmm. and part one is called Confessions of a Chameleon. Now, in mm-hmm. this video, you say that you were abused as a child. Was that true?
Yes.
And is that part of, I mean, do you think that that abuse shaped your interest in self, real self, fictional selves?
I don't think it's ever one thing. I think that, you know, we come to our interest through a number of collisions with real life, and it's all of the things that we encompass in our experience. So certainly everything that we encounter has some resonance in what we become and therefore what we produce as kind of reflections of ourselves.
I guess what I'm curious about with that the Electronic Diaries project is I can't quite tell as a viewer, and I think viewers really aren't meant to be able to tell how much of it is a truthful diary and how much mm-hmm. of it is a portrait of a fictional character that you're making up.
Most of it is truthful, and I think because it's so deeply honest that people presume it's fictional.
I mean, you say you went to college at age 8.
Yeah, I did.
You did?
Yeah. See what I mean?
How did that happen?
Well, they had a special program that I was in Cleveland, and they took some students and had them go to Case Western Reserve for a short time. It was called Major Work at the time, and, you know, they just selected out a number of people to be part of this experimental project.
So were you a child prodigy?
I wouldn't say that, but, you know, they were experimenting with people that tested certain ways on these levels. So,
and did you have the whole college experience? I mean, you went to college with all the other...
No, I didn't get a degree. You know, it was just a short experimental thing. I was in it from 4th to 6th grade, and I went to the college classes one summer.
Did you have a major?
French.
We have to explain that because I can hear listeners thinking, wait, what, you had a fictional character you were living out as? This is, you're talking about Roberta Brightman, right? Your kind of fictional
Roberta
alter.
Roberta Brightmore.
Brightmore. Yeah. Roberta uh-huh. Brightmore, your fictional alter ego.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about her.
Well, in the early 70s, I had an exhibition at the University Art Museum that had sound in it. And the museum closed the show because they said sound wasn't art, media wasn't art, it didn't belong in a museum. So I thought, well, I can make these environments anywhere. Who needs a museum to show them? And I set up with Eleanor Coppola these rooms in a kind of transient hotel. And you were able to go in there 24 hours a day and kind of visit and trespass this room of a presumed identity. The person wasn't there, but all the artifacts of her life was. And that gave birth to the idea of creating a fictional identity that could live in real time, in real life. And therefore, I created this character named Roberta Brightmore, who was kind of modeled after Joyce Carol Oates' heroine in a story, a short story, of a woman who looked for stars and would write these letters to them. And so this fictional character began by looking for a roommate and going out on various adventures. And she lived quite a while keeping a trail and record of all the things that she experienced in her life. And she became a mirror of the culture that she lived in. I mean, she reflected back all the things that were part of living during that time and what it was like for a single woman, a blonde single woman, to experience life on the terms that she met it.
So what did you do to create Roberta? You said she's blonde. You're not.
I'm not. I mean, she looked different than I do. You know, she dressed different than I did. She had her own handwriting. She had her own language, her way of talking, her way of relating to people. She had her own clothing. And so it was a matter of really objectifying a personality, separating it from me and understanding what that particular person would do and how they would react and kind of living that out as a means of really studying identity. I mean, you have to understand that art up to that time, especially art that dealt with women, women's art had no history. It really was written out of the history books. And a lot of women were creating histories, even fictional histories of themselves, in order to kind of create some sort of a beginning of historical stability. So there were women really separately, not even knowing about each other, creating characters, pre-Cindy Sherman, as Kewpie dolls, as waitresses, as kings, all over the country. But Roberta was the most enduring in that she lasted as long as she did and went into as much depth. I mean, she saw a psychiatrist, and I really, really outlined, you know, all the details of defining what a personality meant.
Wait, so she saw a psychiatrist. So you went to a psychiatrist in character as Roberta?
Yes. Roberta went. She was different from me. She had different problems than I did.
Was that ever confusing?
Yes. And in fact, that's why we started the multiples, because after a while, Roberta started to have really negative experience, and I thought maybe I was projecting something onto her. So I hired three people to go out as her, who dressed like her, who looked like her, who had her makeup.
All at the same time?
Yeah,
simultaneously. So you made Roberta clones?
Yes, multiples, I called them in those days, but they really were clones.
What kind of negative experiences did she have?
Well, she would answer ads for a roommate, for instance. And in one episode of her Meet Mr. America series, she answered an ad, and it was really a prostitution ring that was trying to encourage her to join it.
How did she or you escape from the prostitution ring? Did you ever feel at risk yourself, personally?
Yes, always. And in fact, I had a photographer who would take surveillance photographs of these episodes, which I used to document her afterwards, and he was frightened and ran off. So Roberta had to go into the ladies' room and become Lynn, you know, take off the wig and makeup, and they didn't recognize me when I left. So they were looking for the blonde.
Did you ever feel like you were in danger of confusing yourself and Roberta?
No, because Roberta was, you know, fairly objectified, you know, and when in character as Roberta, you know, I was always aware of that.
What did your friends and family think of this? I mean, did they...
Well, nobody understood that piece. I have to say, you know, a lot of people thought I was schizophrenic. Not very many people knew about it when it was going on because they never publicized it or exhibited it till it was over. But, you know, my daughter thought it was weird.
How old was she at the time?
She was 11.
I can imagine that would be really unnerving.
Yeah, yeah. And you can't really explain that it's an artwork. Nobody takes your word for it. But it took 25 years or so for it to really be historified and people to understand, you know, how predictive this was of kind of future works that would happen in our culture.
Mm-hmm. So how established did Roberta's life get? How real did she become?
Well, she was able to get credit cards when I couldn't. So she was, I mean, if one were to go back to that point in time, she would have more of a record than I could. Than I did at that time. But she did get a driver's license, you know, had a checking account, was able to establish credit cards and take temporary jobs and have her own apartment.
She had an apartment?
Yeah.
So you rented her an apartment?
Yes. Hmm. And clothing and makeup and all of that. That kind of defines what a person is.
What happened to Roberta?
Roberta was finally exorcised in Lucrezia Borgia's crypt in Italy in 1979. Lucrezia Borgia's crypt became the Museum of Modern Art in Ferrara, Italy. And that seemed an appropriate place to have her exorcism. And the multiples went there for the exhibition. There was an exhibition of Roberta, and the multiples went there and performed the exorcism and, you know, took her photograph and burnt it. So, you know, she turned into ash and roses like the phoenix into the next artwork.
Well, since then, you've moved on into new media and especially into technology. How has technology, do you think, affected the way you create art that deals with identity?
Well, you know, there are a lot of the same ideas that were in the early hotel rooms or Roberta. Roberta, I saw as an interactive vehicle, you know, that had kind of this random memory. And technology just made those early ideas more accessible. I mean, after Roberta, I made a piece which is credited as being the first interactive video disc that an artist made, you know, using computers in this way to create an artwork. And that was about a woman who was afraid to leave her home, unlike Roberta, who left her home all the time. And one used a remote switch and could control the character's life and decisions by just using this remote. But as new technology develops, it kind of inspires new works that talk about our culture at that particular time. I have a piece called Cynthia, which is a woman who responds through varying behaviors to the changes in the stock market. The market goes up, she dances and goes shopping. If it goes down, she takes a gun to her head and starts drinking. And this I see as a cultural portrait of how our behavior is linked to the economics or our economic index, you know, personal economic index. And the works, you know, the new robot works too, you know, are dealing with more collective memory. And when they're tied to an internet, as is this latest robot called Dina, you know, it recalls the entire information of the internet. So it becomes a real piece of connectivity rather than singularity or singular individuation or personality. It becomes a personality of everybody that's live and wired. So
with some of your more recent works, no one person is having to anymore act out one of your fictional characters. I mean, here you've got this robot, Dina, who lives and breathes. Well, not breathes.
Well, I mean, she pulsates.
Tell me about Dina.
Well, I made a film called Technolust 3 years ago. And in it, there were three self-replicating automatons.
Loneliness lives on our net frontier. Even motherboards and flash require touch. Think of passion each time you click me into you. E-dream with me before you crash.
And I wanted to create both this character online that people could interact with and have it as a distributed media system as well as a linear one on a film. Well, she gestated this robot, and now there's a new one called Dina. And Dina's connected to the internet. She has voice synthesis and speech recognition, and you can go up to her and talk to her.
Do you believe in God?
Yes, I do believe in God. In fact, I speak with her frequently.
And she has mood swings and reacts to you in different ways. You can go to her 2 months later and she'll remember you. And she kind of feeds off of the interaction of people, very much in a sense like Roberta, but kind of updated to what technology will allow or what we've invented for technology, which many times we do. We kind of invent these things before there is the technological component. And by the time we finish, you know, it's readily accessible and what we've done is obsolete.
So as an artist, you're really right on the cutting edge of media, of new media, then new technology. I mean, have you wanted to do things and people have said, no, we don't have the technology to do that yet?
It's not just technology. I want to do things all the time and people say I can't. So you have to find a way to do it, you know, one way or another. But the thing I like about technology and new media is that it is precisely that it has no history. And when you work with things with no history, you really can create their future. You know, maybe that's, you know, going back to the whole Roberta days of dealing with an issue that had no history and kind of redefining what the future will be by creating its own essence in reality.
What are you working on now?
Well, we're putting a lot of these bots together. So one thing I noticed is, you know, when the robots not only talk to people, but they could talk to each other. And when they're in a community, their personalities change. So one becomes more aggressive, one becomes shy and passive. And so I'm making something called a botanical garden, where these bots live on cell phones and react to each other.
Lynn Hirschman-Leeson is an artist and filmmaker. She spoke with Anne Strangechamps. There's a new book out about Hirschman-Leeson's art. It's called The Art and Films of Lynn Hirschman-Leeson, Secret Agents, Private Eye. If you'd like to find out more about Hirschman-Leeson's work, you can find a link to her website on our website, ttbook.org. It used to be that if you ever dreamed of being a wizard or a warrior, you had to use your imagination. Maybe play a role-playing game like Dungeons & Dragons. But thanks to technology, there's another option now. Massively multiplayer online role-playing games. Edward Castronova is the author of Synthetic Worlds, The Business and Culture of Online Games. Castronova's introduction to the world of online role-playing games was a game called EverQuest.
When you first load it up, you just have this character that appears in an environment, and you can press a few buttons and you can move your character around. And then there's a little box on the screen, and in the box are people chatting. So what that is you see someone's name and then the message that they typed. So you might see someone typing, I'm looking for a ride to go to the zone of Darnassus. And then someone else might say, hi, everybody, I'm trying to sell my patch of red fur. Would you please buy it? And so you're standing there and you're kind of reading these, and immediately you can tell, okay, there are people communicating and I don't understand what they're communicating about. And then you might get the sensation that somebody might be looking at you, like they're making requests of you, because these characters will come running up and they'll kind of look at you. And so my first reaction was basically I went and I hid. I was like, oh my gosh, this is too freaky. You know, everyone's probably looking at me and can tell I'm just being an idiot. I don't know what I'm doing. So I ran into a tent and I hid back there and just sort of listened to people talking for a long time. I found out later that the characters that I was running away from were actually not being run by people at all. They were characters being run by this software with these pre-programmed conversations. And so they were saying to one another, hey, would you like to have a beer? And just kind of, you know, enlivening the local atmosphere. And here I thought it was real human beings.
It was all designed to make you feel comfortable in a new environment.
Right. And instead I thought, oh my goodness, I'm going to make some faux pas. I don't know what anyone's talking about.
Well, at some point, though, it must have become more real to you and you began to realize that there were other people there. Do you remember when you first sort of entered the society?
Yeah, I actually had a gradual acculturation process. So I began to kind of see what people were doing. And a typical thing in a game like EverQuest was that people were trying to make their characters more powerful. And the way you do that is you go and you try to defeat challenges. You get a quest from some character in the world who says, please, you know, take this ribbon over to the tailor on the other side of this area. And off you go, and then something attacks you and you have to fight it with your sword. And so I got in the habit of doing that. And I really learned something, though, when I made my first general broadcast statement to everybody who was in the area. I needed to get, for some quest I was doing, I needed to get across a zone that had a lot of monsters in it. I knew they would kill me. And I thought to myself, well, maybe I can get some help from a more powerful character. So I went bravely to the edge of the city where it was just still safe, and I opened up the chat box and put it on the sort of the loudest setting, the yell setting, and I said some sort of Elizabethan flowery, you know, hail, bold adventurers. I seek to cross the dangerous zone of Flanipina, and I request your assistance. Please come to meet me. And they just broke out laughing. Because it turns out you never speak that way. Even though it's a role-playing game and you're supposed to be warriors and mages, if you sound like Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings movies, everyone laughs at you. So they're like, oh, shut up, you noob, which is a term for a newbie, new person. Yeah. And, you know, of course, I'm sitting there beat red at home. My character's not turning red. But and so then you learn, okay, that's not what you do. You just say, hey, can somebody help me get across the zone? And when I did that, I was just fine.
Yeah. Well, gradually, you obviously became comfortable there. When was it that you began to realize that you were watching something that was professionally interesting to you? When did the economy of this place begin to become noticeable?
Well, it struck me when I entered a certain zone and the chat box that I just referred to of people talking to one another lit up. It just absolutely lit up. Things were scrolling through so rapidly that it was just the eye couldn't follow it. And you had to sort of do stuff to make the box bigger and slow it down. There was just so much information passing through, and it was all information about markets. There's people selling things. There were all these merchants in this one area standing around. It was interesting because it wasn't a market area. It wasn't designated by the designers as, you know, the market of Freeport. No, it was actually a sort of a barren area, a tunnel. And I said, what is going on? And I walked into this tunnel area where everybody said, you know, come and meet me to buy this, that, and the other. And I go in and hear hundreds of characters standing around, not fighting monsters, not exploring, evidently not socializing. All they were doing was hawking wares. And so here's this open-air bazaar that had emerged spontaneously in this tunnel for reasons that I found out later related to transit routes and all this other stuff, completely unintended by the designers. And I thought, my goodness, there's an emergent market. And at that moment, I decided to start writing down price tallies. And what really won me over is the more things I wrote down, the bigger this economy turned out to be. Until today, it's actually quite substantial.
Now, what I gather started to interest you, there are many things that have caught your attention, is that there is a kind of a transfer between the economic life inside the game and outside the game. Can you explain that to me?
Well, the basic situation is that it is possible to work your way forward in the game by using real money. Here's how you can do that. Let's say somebody else has accumulated a gazillion gold pieces, doesn't want to play the game anymore. So they have a character that has a gazillion gold pieces, and you want those gold pieces. Now, you could take your character to his character and say, hey, why don't you just give them to me? But, you know, that's cumbersome, and you don't know who has the stuff. So what people do is they might go online and go to eBay and see, is anybody selling their gold pieces? So a fellow who's got a bunch and isn't going to play anymore could just post an auction on eBay saying, hey, if anybody's interested, I have 25 million gold pieces in this fantasy world. I don't need them anymore. Give me $50, 50 real U.S. dollars, and they're yours. And so innocently enough, a market based on that transaction emerged. And you could go to eBay a few years ago and see hundreds of auctions of people selling their gold pieces and magic wands and all this for real money. And then, of course, it didn't take too long for other people to realize this is a profit-making opportunity, and so now it's become a profession. You know, folks just go into the virtual world, mine it for the gold pieces, sell it on eBay, and make a decent living.
The other interesting question, though, is what impact this is having on the games, because presumably it was set up so that you would earn money for doing things that mattered, and now instead people are saying, well, I don't feel like being a grunt for the first 5 years. I think I'll buy my way in.
I'm actually terribly concerned about that. I think one of the great things about the technology is, you know, it's an opportunity to have a world apart, a city on a hill almost, if you will, designed according to what the designers think the players want to do, and then you go off and you have a separate existence, which can include a separate economic existence. So if you feel frustrated in your day job, you could see your empire grow by, you know, gradually building up something in the virtual world. And I think that's a restorative, corrective, positive experience for someone to have that gets ruined when, you know, you work your way up and then all of a sudden you realize you've just been beaten by some kid whose dad is a lawyer who whipped out a checkbook and bought his way forward. Right. You know, if we're going to live out a Horatio Alger myth, which is what these places kind of allow you to do, you know, and you can't live it out in the real world, heaven knows, you know, that would be great. That would be a cool thing. Then, you know, the same forces that defeat Horatio Alger myths in the United States, the rags to riches myth, and in the real world, to come into the virtual world and ruin it there, you know, that's a problem. So I generally oppose the use of real money to advance yourself in a fantasy world. If you're going to use money to advance yourself, do it in the real world. There are ample opportunities out here.
Well, besides this economic interreaction between virtual and real world, are there things that still make it worth playing? Are there other interesting things going on in these online fantasy games?
Yeah, thankfully this real money trade, we call it, is not the dominant characteristic of what's going on. I mean, there are very sophisticated social effects that are interesting to study. We're going to learn a lot about human learning from this environment because you've got these social effects in a constructed environment that's got goals. And, you know, is there any reason why I could not at Indiana University build a fantasy world based on the work of William Shakespeare? Exact same game mechanics, but all the texts and all the lore are just Shakespeare. Is it not the case that people who get into that world are going to learn a lot about the world's greatest writer? So there's some interesting educational things. There's also research implications, you know, because you could think of these places as petri dishes for planning out public policy, you know, things like security, response to epidemics. There's actually a lot of implications of this technology.
Are there online games that resemble the real world? Are there political fantasy games, for instance?
At the moment, no. There isn't a game based on, let's say, the United States election, although that would be an interesting thing. There is a game that pretty closely resembles the real world. It's called Second Life, and it's actually not a game. It's more of a venue. It's a place where people can have a character, like a video game character called an avatar, and you can buy land there and you can build things there. And so you could build a house or you could build a game for people to play, and you could charge them money to come and experience the content that you made. That world is very open and connected to the real economy. So the reason they call it Second Life is it's sort of like a second life for you. So it's not trying to be a fantasy game. It's trying to be an extension of the real world and an enhancement, if you will.
Edward Castronova is the author of Synthetic Worlds, the business and culture of online games. If you have questions or comments about this program, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll conclude our Hour on Identity with a profile of singer-songwriter Robbie Foulkes. I'm Jim Fleming, I think. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Robbie Foulkes is widely regarded as one of the most gifted songwriters working these days. Although you'd probably classify his music as alternative country, Foulkes knows his way around all kinds of pop music genres. During the 1990s, Foulkes combined the roles of artist and businessman by working as a songwriter for a Nashville music publisher. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon prepared this profile of Robbie Foulkes.
Well, I came down to Nashville in 1993 'cause my friend Jimmy said Nashville had money growing right on the trees. So I thought I'd go pick some, and that don't mean musically. Now it's 3 years later, and I'm wondering where I went wrong. Shook a lot of hands, ate a lot of lunch, wrote a lot of dumbass songs, but I couldn't get a break in Nashville if I tried my whole life long.
That's Robbie Foulkes with a song called, well, let's call it Screw This Town. That's what Foulkes calls it when he mentions it in just a moment. And if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for me. This song could well serve as the theme song for Foulkes' career. It's a career that's been a reaction to the mega Disney World kind of atmosphere that Foulkes says developed on Music Row after Garth Brooks became such a huge success.
My whole career, so to speak, has been a reaction against that in a way, because before I made records, I worked in Nashville for a publishing company writing songs for, you know, people like Garth Brooks and that whole thing in the early 90s. And I really, I think, bridled at the constraints that I had to work under at that time. You know, you couldn't write a traditional groove, you couldn't write a shuffle, you couldn't write, there's a lot of stuff you couldn't do, and you had to aim it squarely at women or at their idea of the women's audience, which, you know, whatever, it's fine that they've identified this thing and it works for them, but it really wasn't what I wanted to do. I like the older groove, I think, because it's a little bit more just brutally honest, and it comes from the heart of a guy sitting at 3 a.m. and writing something from his heart, and not from a committee of guys meeting at 10 in the morning in the conference room to write a hit.
And they didn't just tell Foulkes what kind of grooves to write. They also told him what words to use and not to use.
I had a song which referenced a woman's fingernails, and they said, well, you can't say fingernails in a song, you know, that makes a woman sound like an animal, you know, it sexualizes women too much, all sorts of little petty stuff like that. And I'm sure that there's artists out there, you know, now and then that would cut a song that had a little bit of a risque thing in it like that. But, you know, all of that was just a reaction to one thing, Garth Brooks hitting it really big, and that was the model for the music for the next 6-7 years. You know, it's really unfortunate, but it's like any other business. When one thing hits really big, it's just rank imitation, mindless mimicry. And the good stuff, you know, or the artful stuff just has to find a way to break through. But all the writers work under those constraints and have to find their own ways to sneak quality stuff in.
Or you can just write quality stuff that doesn't have a hope of making the cut.
I probably wrote several songs almost as infantile reactions against those constraints that I had to work under. You have to make everything so sensitive all the time. You know, I'd sit down, well, I'm going to write a song called, you know, Screw This Town, you know, to use a euphemism. I'm going to write a song, God Isn't Real, and just see where that leads me. I'd turn them in, and the guys at the publishing house would kind of nod curtly and look at the title, and, you know, there goes Robbie again.
Go ask the starving millions under Stalin's cruel reign. Go ask the child with cancer who eases her pain. Then go to your churches if that's how you feel.
And it's a safe bet that Foulkes' Nashville songwriting gig played a part in one of his latest songs, Fountains of Wayne Hotline. This song is a good-natured and witty deconstruction of the band Fountains of Wayne's songwriting style.
Fountains of Wayne Hotline, Gerald speaking. How can I help you?
Oh, yeah, thanks. Hello. I'm a country singer in a small Midwestern town, and I'm here in the studio today. Let me explain. We're working on a track.
We can help you.
Okay.
What you need to do now is employ the radical dynamic shift. Full band entry, fortissimo, while maintaining consistent apparent volume on the vocal track.
Oh. Yeah, that's a great idea. Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. We're always here.
It's such a drag to face another filthy stage.
Robbie Foulkes' latest album is called Georgia Hard. It's Foulkes' most fully realized album to date. The witty wordplay and great sense of humor are still there, but there's also a certain maturity, a poignancy that can be found in both the lyrics and in the various styles of country music that Foulkes uses. How does he describe the Georgia Hard album?
Well, I would say it's just plain country, you know. It's got a little bit of a 70s bent to it, a little bit of a tribute, I guess, to writers like Bill Anderson and John Hartford, Jerry Reed, you know, singers like Gene Watson and Mel Street, that whole era of sort of country for adults. To me, it's the generation after Hank Williams that kind of mellowed it out a little bit and addressed suburban adult concerns.
Foulkes talked about the title track of the Georgia Hard album.
Well, the title track, it's kind of about like where I grew up. I grew up in the South and came to the North later, and only now, you know, I'm 42 now, and you know, at the time I couldn't wait to get out of there and out of North Carolina, out of the farm life and all the rest of it. I thought it was kind of pokey and backwards, but I think a lot of kids probably feel that way about where they're from, and now I look back on it with a little tinge of nostalgia, I guess. But that song is pretty autobiographical, you know, as my songs go.
So please, Mr. Conway, you accept the charges when I told you a cold day and thinking I lied. And if your pecan trees still need a shaking, well, I'll be back begging fast as the gray dawn flies. 'Cause there's no Carolina moon over Chicago. Countryer than thou, countryer than thou. You wasn't raised in a shack, so better not act so. Countryer than thou. Some people just don't understand it. If you come from where the kudzu grows, they think the sound is like a planet of peckerwoods and bozos. When I was young, I picked some tubers and took a swig of moonshine, but I never saw so many goobers until the day I crossed that line. Countryer than thou.
That's another one. I guess, you know, if that record has a theme, it's kind of looking back on Southern boyhood and where you're from. And that song also comes out of coming north and playing country music in the north and noticing that people are a lot more, I don't know, some people are a lot more ideological in their attitude toward country music and toward keeping it country at all costs and, you know, playing it the way it was played and not hybridizing and not innovating sometimes. I don't know, I always thought that was kind of funny, you know, that those people are located in Boston and Detroit, places like that, rather than Birmingham, Alabama.
One of the most beautiful songs on Georgia Hard is a song called I Never Did Like Plains, which has kind of a Latin feel.
I think a lot of the songs on my new record bear on directly on older styles. That song refers pretty explicitly to Don Williams and that really minimal sound that he got with his producers Alan Reynolds and Garth Fundis back in his early 70s records. You're right, the slight Latin tinge, it's almost kind of corny, but it comes from hands on the drums, you know, sometimes a bongo, and just really minimal and lilting arrangements, just the lightest bit of swing in the arrangement.
One-way ticket flight 703, say goodbye to Tennessee. We had so much, now it's all gone, nothing left but to move along. She said, don't cry, baby,
need, I know. But I'm halfway to heaven, and I still haven't let go. I never did like planes. I'm not one to fly. Well, I guess we'd all have wings if God loved goodbyes. I can't believe that we're all through. I never did like planes, but I sure loved you. I still love you.
I read that one of the things Robbie Foulkes likes about writing country lyrics is that they deal with the big topics of life: love, God, and relationships. So I was curious to find out how much freedom that gives him as a songwriter.
Well, it's sort of anti-freedom, really. I mean, being channeled in these certain directions, you know, to write these little kitchen sink dramas that are the stuff of country music. But I love it. Growing older, it's always seemed to me and seems more and more obvious to me that that's really what life is about these little, you know, who you marry and what your kids are and paying the bills and trying to live an honest and clean kind of a life and being pulled toward various temptations your whole life through. All of that stuff seems to me universal and really crucial and, you know, more than the stuff that a lot of rock and other kinds of songwriters write about. I think, you know, hip-hop and country music and a few other things just really deal with the stuff that hits home to me.
Why to the wheel and mountain go one? Fire up the engine, now the fences go. Breathe in some at the blacktop. The background, there's always a way out. Where there's a road, where there's a road, where there's a road.
That's Robbie Foulkes with Where There's a Road, a song from his latest album, Georgia Hard. Foulkes spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. Robbie Foulkes hosts a show called Secret Country on XM Radio. You can find a link to Foulkes' website on our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 319B, Identity Crisis. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strange Chimps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.